Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor with McLean's Magazine.
The federal party leaders squared off for the first time in French, with the niqab ban at citizenship ceremonies causing some tempers to flare. But now that the first French bout is over, what's next for the Quebec campaign and how does it translate nationally? We break it down with McLean's Montreal Bureau Chief, Martin Patriquin.
Just 3 weeks before Election Day, Kevin Page is releasing a new book about his time as Canada's first parliamentary budget officer. And it's not exactly kind to the Harper government. Kevin Page joins us on the show to discuss his story.
Is Canada in a recession or not? Finance Minister and Conservative candidate Joe Oliver raised eyebrows, saying in an interview that our country was not in a recession in the first half of the fiscal year, despite data and definitions that say otherwise. We speak with a chief economist about a growing debate over what constitutes a recession.
The F-35 has flown back into the spotlight after the Liberals promised they would not buy the controversial fighter jet. We speak with a defense expert about all the party positions on the plane purchase for our military.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. For the first time in this election campaign, federal party leaders squared off in French, and tempers flared over several touchy topics. Not only is it the first French debate, but it was the largest so far, with five leaders taking part, including Bloc Québécois leader Gilles Duceppe and the Green Party's Elizabeth May.
From Quebec's separation to the government's ban on the niqab at citizenship ceremonies, the leaders often raised their voices and talked over each other. The most heated moment came over the debate on the niqab. And at one point, Conservative Stephen Harper and New Democrat Tom Mulcair were loudly arguing and gesturing at each other with their hands. Despite the excitement the debate caused on the stage, from a national perspective, it doesn't appear there was any clear winner. Although the consensus is that Tom Mulcair held his own while having a target on his back.
To break down what the debate means for the Quebec campaign and how it could translate nationally, McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaks with our Montreal Bureau Chief, Martin Patriquin.
I looked at that thing at the outset thinking the action here has to be all directed at Thomas Mulcair. He's leading in the province. He's got the most incumbents. He's leading in a big time in the polls. It's got to be the other guys coming at him and primarily Justin Trudeau coming at him. Is that what you were looking for?
I think actually that In a way, Duceppe, for obvious reasons, had to come at him a little harder. Duceppe had to knock him down. Like, he didn't have a choice. A swing at the fences kind of thing. Was he able to do that? I don't think so, because if you look at the NDP plank, you look at the Bloc Québécois plank, they were violently in agreement on a lot of things. Apart from, you know, the niqab and the pipeline. Look, they're both left of center, sort of the social democratic parties. So it's very hard for Duceppe to come out and really differentiate himself. And when he does differentiate himself, it's on issues like sovereignty, which is, you know, a huge percentage of the voting public in Quebec these days don't necessarily vote on that on those lines anymore, as we saw in 2011. In a way, Trudeau was a bit Duceppe redux, in the sense that even if the Liberal strategy, which is to win Ontario, win big in Ontario, then pick up, you know, pockets here and there, one of those pockets has to be Quebec. They have to win. They have to win.
They have seven seats there now, and I figured they've got about triple that, right, to really be comfortable on election day.
Triple it at least, yeah, for majority, certainly. Yeah. So the stakes weren't quite as high for Trudeau, but they're still fairly high. And don't forget that, I mean, the stakes were very high for Mulcair. Mulcair can't really lose any of those seats to anyone because his power base is in Quebec. He's not polling all that well in Ontario. He's got problems, a little bit of problems on the West Coast. He has a fair bit to lose there. So the thing was that the two players, other than Harper, had, and of course Elizabeth May, but wouldn't leave her out of this, really had to score against them, and I don't think they did it. I think Mulcair handled himself quite well.
Do you think that's partly just a function of the fact that you've got this five-person melee going on, where it's difficult to get a sort of a crisp moment out of that, right? A moment where anyone really seems to gain the upper hand clearly on someone else because there's so many hands in the way.
So yeah, it's almost like a battle on two fronts for these guys, because A, they have to attack Mulcair. same time, they have to attack Harper because everybody wants to get rid of Harper.
Right.
And in that sense, Mulcair was at a little bit of an advantage, is that any time that certainly with Duceppe, when you know he wanted to yell at Harper for example, for corporate taxes, which, you know, he'd be like, well, Harper did this. Well, that's exactly what the NDP would do as well. You see
right,
what I mean
right.
in terms of that. So it put the Bloc and to a certain extent Justin Trudeau at a disadvantage.
Do you think, independent of the debate, do you think that there is any sign that there's going to be big movement in the latter stages of this campaign? I mean, the Quebec electorate has shown itself to be pretty volatile in the past. Do you think we might see something like that again?
It's a bit of a difficult question to answer. I mean, look, Duceppe did fairly well last night.
Mm.
He didn't do what he needed to do, but he did fairly well. So I think there's just going to be a spoiler in here. It'll be like whether or not the Bloc gets enough support to sort of play spoiler in certain ridings.
Is that bringing down the NDP vote? That you mean by spoiler?
Yeah, that brings down the NDP vote, so that would arguably help the Liberals in some areas, arguably help the Conservatives in some areas.
Right.
Certainly on the island of Montreal and the environs, like the sort of the north and the south shore, that would help the Liberals. Elsewhere, that would help the NDP.
How many ridings on the island of Montreal or around Montreal do you think might conceivably be still up for grabs? I guess that's where the Liberals have to be focusing their attention.
That's where the Liberals are focusing their attention, and it's the great unspoken of the Liberal. I mean, anytime you ask these guys, and I remember 2011 enough to remember, like, oh yeah, we're going to win all around. We're going to get seats, you know, around Quebec City. It's like, no, you're not. You're not going to get seats. You're here. You're going to do Montreal. You're going to try to get, you know, at least 15 seats on the island of Montreal that, out of some weird fluke went NDP last time. Maybe pooch a little bit of the Bloc support, but primarily NDP.
Right.
And go at it that way. That's where they're concentrating their resources. You know, Trudeau represents Papineau, which is the classic sort of Montreal riding, very multi-ethnic, et cetera, and those are the ones that they're going to go after.
Do you think all of us outside Quebec are kind of fascinated by Trudeau's odd, interesting position in Quebec. I mean, how do you see him? I mean, we hear that he still carries negative baggage from his father's name. On the other hand, we hear that he's carved out his own persona, especially in his own riding. You mentioned Papineau, where he's got a good following among a sort of multi-ethnic constituency. How do you see him? Do you see him as being, you know, fairly solid, having a kind of independent identity now? Or
the trope about him, you know, carrying the Trudeau name and all that kind of thing, that was true up to about, you know, 10, 15 years ago. I would say there's an element of truth to that. Now, if you're the Liberal campaign, 2 years ago, Trudeau had really good numbers in Quebec.
Yeah.
He was doing well in Quebec popularity-wise. He was doing well money-wise. He went down. He's gone down there since then. So that to me suggests that it's not impossible that a Trudeau can actually be quite popular again in Quebec.
Marty, let me ask you about the NDP incumbents. When they came to Ottawa in 2011, there was a sense around the press gallery here that, well, surely a lot of these rookie, very young, very untested New Democrats will screw up in some way in their first few years. So there'll be a series of gaffes and stumbles.
Yep.
But there really haven't been. They've been pretty solid. Do you have a sense whether that reflects it? Does that matter in the campaign?
Yeah, it's the one area. It was interesting at the beginning of the campaign, the Bloc Québécois went after that, you know, the NDP hasn't done anything for Quebec, hasn't done anything for Brad. That had absolutely no traction, and just for the reason that you explained, was the fact that these MPs haven't. I mean, look, the bar was low, and they managed to get it. They didn't screw up, but that's a huge deal. Like,
yeah.
You know, if you think about the pressure that's put on students coming out of McGill, Université de Montréal, 21 years old, and all of a sudden they're thrust into this thing, and they didn't screw up over 4 years. That's fairly impressive. The other thing that to me is impressive, completely frankly, is Tom Mulcair. He, the punditry, myself included, in 2011 had a sort of cast a woolly eye on the election results, as saying, you know, it's less a vote for the NDP than it was for Jack Layton. That proved not to be true at all, and that's largely due to Tom Mulcair having been able to sustain losing Jack Layton and sustaining the NDP brand in Quebec.
Surely some of that, Marty, has to be the fact that Mulcair and Layton are such different characters with such different political skills that it's hard to draw that. You know, it's hard to draw any comparison between them. Do you know what I mean? Like if Mulcair was a kind of guy who was trying to step into Jack's kind of effusive approachable persona, then that'd be tough. But that's not who he is. He's this compact, contained, tough guy. You know, that's his style. And so, you know, it just makes it hard to think. Oh, is he like Jack? Is he another Jack? No, he's not. He's obviously a very different kind of cat.
Exactly, and that was known in Quebec. He, you know, Mulcair is more so than anywhere else in the country. One of the things that over the last few years is talking about, you know, Tom Mulcair has to get out of the Ottawa bubble. Nobody knows him outside. Well, the one place in the country that they did know him was in Quebec.
Right.
He's a known quantity here, having been elected for so long with the Liberal Party of Quebec, and having been one of the more prominent people first in opposition and then in cabinet. So people knew what they were getting here with Tom Mulcair. It's a mark of how good a politician he is that he was able to have his own person and still sustain the support for the NDP in the province.
That was Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking with our Montreal Bureau Chief Martin Patrickwin about the French debate and what it may mean moving forward for the Quebec and national campaigns.
Still to come on the show, former Parliamentary Budget Officer Kevin Page joins us to discuss his new book about truth and lies on Parliament Hill. We look at the debate over the definition of recession, and a defense expert is here to comment on the Liberal plan to reject the F-35 fighter jet.
Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSwinney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor with Maclean's Magazine.
Coming up on the show, we speak with the chief economist after the finance minister denies there was a recession in the first half of the year, and a defense expert speaks to us about the Liberal plan to reject the F-35 fighter jet. But first,
one of the major promises of the Conservatives in 2006 was the Federal Accountability Act, and when the Harper government first took power, it moved quickly to put that act in place. One of the positions created by the Act was the Parliamentary Budget Officer, a spending watchdog to provide independent economic, fiscal, and financial analysis to Parliament and parliamentarians. The first person to take on that role was Kevin Page, who was officially appointed in 2008.
But it didn't take long for Page to ruffle the feathers of the very government that created his job. Page challenged the government on several issues, most notably the controversial F-35 fighter jet purchase. Page and the Conservative government continued to square off, leading then-Finance Minister Jim Flaherty to call Page unbelievable, unreliable, and incredible. His term was not extended past its first mandate.
Page has now written a book about his experiences as the PBO called Unaccountable, Truth and Lies on Parliament Hill. It hits store shelves next week, but I was able to speak with Page over the phone.
The title, obviously, Unaccountable, doesn't hide the fact that, you know, you think we have a problem here. And there's a lot to talk about in that regard. But how would you summarize the problem exactly, and why should the average citizen, you know, the average voter care about that problem?
Well, I mean, should we care whether, does it matter whether the legislature can hold the executive to account? You know, and I think it does matter. And I think when you lose checks and balances in the systems, you know, I think you run into all kinds of problems. You undermine your democracy. I think eventually you run into significant fiscal problems. You know, so yeah, I think we often found ourselves being in a position where we were providing the only analysis on issues that hadn't, you know, that was serious in that, you know, that you could, you know, it had numbers, it had assumptions, it had, you know, sensitivity type of analysis, it had, you know, people peer reviewing it on major issues, on, you know, major procurement issues or sustainability issues. So I think it does, I mean, it hugely matters. I think all the literature that's out there on institutions, you know, Why Nations Fail, the famous book by Ash McEwan Robinson, The Great Degeneration by Neil Ferguson, shows that, you know, countries prosper when you have strong institutions. And one of the big differences between, you know, successful developed industrial economies and, you know, economies that are still struggling, more emerging economies, is the strength of their institutions. So if we undermine that, you know, if we don't give the parliament the information they need to hold the government to account, then there'll be a price to pay.
Is it inevitable that, you know, there was a certain novelty to your office existing and there being a something to measure the government against, and when there was a discrepancy between the two, there was obviously a controversy and a story there. Is it inevitable that the government and the PBO, if the PBO is doing its job well, that there are going to be some conflicts? There are going to be times when you're going to be producing different numbers, and do we just sort of kind of have to adjust to that reality?
Yeah, I think it's a healthy reality, healthy in a democracy, but just healthy as well. I mean, when you're making, again, in what we're talking about the, you know, governments, effectively moving forward, with hopefully with legislation from Parliament on spending taxpayers' money, so they're not spending their own money. And I think as homeowners, as consumers, when we're spending our own money, we will often check out, if we're purchasing a house or a car, even clothing, we're looking for best prices, we're looking at quality, there's multiple data points. We might, if it's a big purchase, we're reading material. So, I think it's very healthy to get different data points. I don't think I think the issues of the vision of prime ministers, the priorities that they set, the direction, are extremely important. And I think as financial people, and I've been, one for many decades in the public service environment, you want to make sure that when our parliamentarians are making those decisions, either in accountability context or the executive in terms of moving forward in new programs or procurement, that they have this financial information close by, so they're spending money wisely. But different data points is a good thing. I remember it's kind of an astonishing moment after we released our F-35 costing, and the government had released their costing really just through a press release, a 1-2-page document by the minister. We had tabled the report, and I went to a meeting of defense people, kind of contractors, to kind of explain how we came up with our numbers. I remember a former senior military person that was involved in CF-18 said, "Kevin, now look what you've done. Now we have two numbers." And it was just kind of astonishing to me in a way that I'll never forget. Like, what's the problem of having a few different numbers on a major purchase like that, with given that all the uncertainty that's still around the F-35? Like, I think that's not a bad thing. And what we tried to do at PBO was, in a very professional way, to make sure people understood, like, how we came to those numbers. And, they knew, what were those assumptions, what was the methodology, and, effectively, what were the range of numbers around what we were saying.
Both the NDP and the Liberals now have promised to empower the PBO and improve the situation. Do you have much hope that a new government would materially, improve the office? And at the same time, I mean, how inevitable is it that, they're going to come to a point where they don't, necessarily love what the office is doing?
Well, I think, in the context of debate and discourse, and there's going to be, and if we're moving forward on significant issues, hopefully we'll get the issues, those bigger issues of, healthcare, or like really fixing infrastructure issues, or dealing with, the environment, climate change. So I think we will get to, we'll be changing programs significantly. We'll be potentially changing our tax code to deal with these issues. I think you do want to have a lot of analysis. I think you want the public service operating in a different way than they've operated in the past 10 years. I think you want a parliamentary budget office running on all its cylinders. You'd want the think tanks and universities engaged. I think if we don't get all of that, I don't see how we're going to make progress against those really major issues. So, I'm heartened that the three opposition parties are all calling for strengthening the office, changing appointment, making the position an officer of Parliament, so you reinforce its responsibilities and accountabilities to Parliament. So I think it's a good thing. And often, again, obviously that happens when you have parties in opposition. The government is not asking for a strengthening of the parliamentary budget office, but it was the Conservative Party while they were in opposition that wanted the parliamentary budget office back in 2005. So I think it seems to be like a natural sequence of events.
You had an issue this week with the NDP and their costing platform. What I guess was the basis for that concern, and how could we sort of improve that?
Well, I think it's an issue that opposition parties do not have access to the kind of expertise in general that that would help them with with platform development, with platform costing. The criticism that I made, or the concern that I flagged with respect to the NDP, was a thin document that perhaps we should have seen more. And a document that was costing, that was based on numbers which is the case for all parties, not just the NDP. They're outdated because of a weaker economy in 2015 and what we seem to be is, well, lower oil prices or energy prices in general going forward. So, I mean, I just think that we need to get to a place where we look at options, where opposition parties can go to, reputable think tanks, that this work could be done in a very standard, nonpartisan way, that we have, the level of transparency that I think, perhaps the media that play this sort of a state role in terms of scrutiny, Canadians can kind of scrutinize, are these numbers, do we have enough kind of clarity, is it clear that the government will, or a new government might hit its objectives? So, I mean, I was, raising issues. I think, but it should still be said that the NDP did release their numbers, I think before, after the Green Party, but before the Liberals, and we still haven't seen really a full costing of the Conservative measures. They used the government 2015 forecast. It's a bit outdated, but everybody else, we haven't seen the other more up-to-date numbers really from other parties. I was raising really concerns around a thin doc, but I think we need to get to use think tanks. Some countries like Australia and the Netherlands are using their legislative budget offices to do costings of, opposition platforms.
That was former Parliamentary Budget Officer Kevin Page speaking about his new book, Unaccountable, Truth and Lies on Parliament Hill, which goes on sale next week.
Still to come, we speak with the chief economist about the debate over the definition of a recession, and a defense expert weighs in on the renewed talk of rejecting the F-35 fighter jet. Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor with Maclean's Magazine. Still to come on the show, we speak with a defense expert to see if the Liberal plan to reject F-35 fighter jets makes any sense. But first,
recession? What recession? That seemed to be the question Finance Minister and Conservative candidate Joe Oliver was asking this week. He took a moment away from campaigning in his hotly contested Toronto riding and sat down for an interview with the Associated Press to discuss the economy. In that interview, Oliver said he doesn't believe Canada was in a recession for the first half of the year, and he doesn't believe it is now.
That raised some eyebrows because it came after Stats Canada had released the official numbers showing negative growth in the second quarter of the year. Since that was the second consecutive quarter in the red, that reaches the technical definition of a recession. In fact, the government even has that definition in its own balanced budget law that was passed in the House of Commons just 3 months ago.
But defining a recession may not be that simple. In fact, even economists are debating the definition. To dive deeper into this issue, I speak with Todd Hirsch, the chief economist for ATB Financial.
Was Canada in a recession for the first portion of this fiscal year?
Well, currently, as the way Statistics Canada holds their technical definition of recession, yes. Stats Canada didn't get the numbers wrong. We did meet the technical definition, which was two consecutive quarters of contraction in the GDP. So in a very technical sense, we were in recession. They didn't get that wrong. That is the definition. So we did meet that.
Okay, so then that really does bring us into this argument over the definition of what is a recession. The government has had the same definition from Stats Canada, or as Stats Canada, in terms of two consecutive quarters of negative growth. But is there an argument amongst economists that needs to change? Is there a push for change, or do economists seem satisfied that is the proper definition?
Well, there is a push, actually, for changing, at least if not the definition, then let's at least maybe put more nuance on what we mean by recession, because there is a technical definition, or there's a technical, sort of the qualifications of meeting that. But there is, in a very different way, a practical sense of recession. And that's what I think Canadians, when they think of being in recession, they think of unemployment rising, they think of job loss, they think of manufacturing or the housing market sort of deteriorating. None of those things for the Canadian economy were really happening in the first half of 2015. So it didn't really, in a practical sense, it didn't really feel recessionary for most Canadians. Alberta is a different situation, but for most Canadians, it didn't feel like a recession. So then it gets back to the debate, well, does the technical definition of recession, is that adequate, or do we need to sort of layer on a bit more nuance? And what do we mean when we talk as politicians or as economists, what do we mean by recession?
So you mentioned some of the other factors there, and I know other jurisdictions like the United States have a different definition for recession, and they do take into account other factors. What are the specific factors that are taken into account, and how gray is that? Because if you start to take certain things, like is there a certain cutoff? Are there certain economic markers that are tied to those other indicators that would allow an economist to say we're in a recession? Or is it just sort of a look at all of them and collectively sort of just using your judgment and saying, yeah, I think we're in a recession?
Yeah, in the United States, which is the one that we're always sort of comparing ourselves with, in the U.S., they do have the National Bureau of Economic Research. It's sort of a nonpartisan, committee of economists that is appointed by the government. And this committee makes a judicial sort of estimate on when the recession started and when it ended. And they do look at other factors rather than just the GDP. They do look at employment numbers. They do look at spending, consumer spending numbers. They look at the housing market. They look at, you know, probably a dozen or more different indicators and make a judgment based on those indicators. And then they time when the recession began and when it ended. Now, in a lot of ways, this is a superior way to do it because it is that more nuanced, you know, sort of flavor to what do we mean by recession. So it's better in that sense. Where it has a serious drawback, however, is the timing of it, because often the National Bureau of Economic Research, they're making they're sort of pinpointing the beginning of a recession, sometimes, you know, a year or two after it already started. And often they're timing the end of it, you know, even up to a year after it already ended. So it's always very backward looking. I think they give an accurate time frame of when the recession began and ended, but it's always sort of yesterday's news, like a year or two ago. So it really becomes only more interesting for academics or, you know, maybe those people who look at recessions in the past and try to correlate it with policies that were going on. So it's interesting for academics. It gives a very good read of when a recession began and ended, but it is more or less useless for the average American, or in this case, the average Canadian, to say, well, you know, we had a recession 2 years ago. The National Bureau of Economic Research just sort of pinpointed the dates. So it's maybe interesting, but it's not really very relevant because it's dated information. Stats Canada, I mean, their definition, that technical definition, it might not be as nuanced, but it's much more timely anyway. So there's pros and cons, but I do think that in general, Canadian economists were a little bit impatient with this whole talk of recession, especially because it came during a federal election campaign and politicians were using it to their advantage to say, see, look, you know, we're in recession. And economists were more or less unanimous saying, well, it didn't really mean very much in that sense.
And at the same time, politicians are also talking a lot about deficits and surpluses. And I think economists have said on whole that a little deficit, a little surplus really doesn't make that much of a difference when it comes to the economy as a whole.
Exactly. It's sort of like quibbling over, you know, is it plus 1 degree outside or is it minus one? Well, it's more or less going to be indistinguishable. It's just sort of a technical thing. But it's a lot colder than it was maybe back in July. So, yeah, I think this whole question of deficits and debt, or the deficit anyway, politicians can become, I think, a little bit too focused on this absolute, you know, balance. And it really does, month after month, it's more or less luck of the draw if it's going to be higher or lower that month. In the case of Mr. Harper, and you know, it worked in his favor, but it could have just as well easily gone the other way, too. So,
and on the U.S. model, just to jump back to that, you talked about the risks of that. Could that also, you know, inadvertently prolong a recession if they're delayed in announcing the start of a recession and they're delayed in announcing the end of a recession? If you know, Americans or Canadians find out that they're in a recession and they've got, you know, the headlines or this feeling that hangs over their heads, could it ruin consumer confidence? Could it pull back spending and in the end sort of prolong a recession just by not allowing people to get back to spending and allow the economy to sort of kickstart again?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I've always been, you know, as an economist myself, I've always been very hesitant to put too much emphasis on this word recession, simply because it could trigger negative sentiment among consumers. Just hearing that word, that R word, even consumers who are, you know, they're in fiscally, they're in good shape, their jobs are stable, but they might pull back on spending even though they don't need to, or even though that's now changing a decision they would normally make. So I think there is a chance or a danger that talk of recession can alter consumer sentiment in a negative way that is unhelpful, especially if the economy is slowing down. And that's why I'm in that camp of economists that says we shouldn't really get too caught up in this recession word, you know, and this technical definition of it.
On the flip side, the current definition of recession, could that also curb consumer spending if Canadians hear that word when things really aren't that bad, but they hear the word recession and sort of get frightened away from spending some of their dollars?
Yeah, well, if they are hearing that word, and there was a lot of talk of that word, you know, back in when Stats Canada came out with that report, there was a lot of media attention to it, a lot of political attention by the opposition parties, and a lot of emphasis on, see, we're in recession. And I do think there is that danger that people hear that and they make a judgment on it, and they start to feel less confident about their own economic situation and their financial situation. And that's all very unhelpful, especially when, you know, in a practical sense, it really doesn't mean that much. I mean, if Stats Canada had come out and said, oh, actually, we got better growth in the second quarter, and we just avoided, you know, it wasn't a recession after all. Well, that could actually then, you know, lead to maybe a little bit of a false sense of you know, well-being in the economy. If it was just below zero or just above zero, in any case, the Canadian economy is underperforming, and I think that's what we need to focus on, rather than was it technically, you know, a contraction or technically just above zero.
All right, then finally, I guess the question is change. If there is a large majority of economists, let's just say, that is really pushing for a change in definition of the word recession, how does that happen? Does it have to go through the government? And if so, how confident are you that there would be any change, if at all, moving forward?
Well, at this point, we don't really have a body or a committee, not like they do in the United States. We have Statistics Canada, but Statistics Canada, that is not their role. Stats Canada's role is to collect data, and they do a very good job of it, and they have this technical definition of a recession. But what Canada doesn't have, what we're lacking that the U.S. does have, is that, you know, the National Bureau of Economic Research. Years and years ago, we used to have the Economic Council of Canada, which was funded by the federal government and I think some other sources of private funding. And that would have been a good role for the Economic Council of Canada to play, but decades ago, they got rid of that. So we don't really have a nonpartisan body of economists whose job it is to make a judicial sort of analysis and decision on these recessions. So we don't have the mechanism. So because of that, I don't see that changing in the short run, and I really don't see an appetite on the behalf of the current or the Harper government, or, you know, even the a future government, to set up a new Bureau of Economic Research here in Canada. I just hear no talk or no appetite for that.
All right, so I guess we're going to be sticking with the technical definition that we have right now, at least for the near future.
At least for the near future. I mean, whoever forms government, if they find it might be to their advantage to set something up, you know, there might be that. But I haven't heard much talk or, you know, demands for that. I think generally economists in the country would say, yeah, there would be a role to put together. And it doesn't have to cost a lot of money. You know, but there would be a role to put together a committee of professional, nonpartisan economists and task them with this job of, you know, analyzing a range of economic indicators, including the GDP, and to make some decisions or make some judgments on when a recession starts and when a recession ends.
That was Todd Hirsch, the chief economist of ATB Financial, discussing the definition of a recession.
Coming up after the break, we speak with a defense expert to break down the renewed debate over the controversial F-35 fighter jet.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor with McLean's Magazine.
This week, the controversial F-35 fighter jet roared into the election campaign with Justin Trudeau vowing that a Liberal government would not buy the so-called Joint Strike Fighter. Instead, he would hold an open competition for cheaper options and use the billions saved to help the Navy. Stephen Harper fired back that exiting the international consortium that's developing the cutting-edge F-35 would crater Canada's aerospace industry. Thomas Mulcair said an NDP government would allow Lockheed Martin's F-35 to compete with other aircraft in open bidding to supply the Canadian forces with new jets.
To sort out the party's various positions, McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes spoke with defense expert David Perry of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute. John started out by asking Perry if Trudeau's decision to exclude the F-35 seems defensible to those who work in the world of multi-billion dollar military procurements.
I think the way that they've done it is defensible certainly to a certain extent because they didn't just take that measure. They did it as part of their campaign platform on defense writ large. So they're positioning it as part of a set of choices they think they have to make, which I would be in agreement with regarding the overall affordability situation at national defense, whereby there's at present there's too many different projects competing for an insufficient source of defense budget, which can't cover them all.
Right.
So they're stating up front that they would make that particular move by trying to find a cheaper fighter aircraft alternative as the first step in trying to bring national defense into a more affordable overall budget situation.
So the idea is, sir, if
the first step is, sorry.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry, I didn't interrupt.
And they would take the savings that they'd realize by that, and as a first priority, reallocate the money to the Navy where there's well-identified shortfalls in that particular budget area.
So the idea is we'd end up, we'd still buy a fighter jet, but it would be presumably a less expensive fighter jet. The money saved by stepping away from the F-35 stealth fighter program, that gets devoted to the more pressing need, which is to find some money for the Navy. Is that about right?
That's exactly what they are suggesting that they would do.
Okay, so let me play the devil's advocate on behalf of sort of the other parties here. So the NDP position is, no, we need a proper competitive process to decide which fighter jet we want, but we shouldn't take the F-35 out of the mix until we've gone through that process. Is that a defensible position, do you think?
Absolutely. And I think one of the weaknesses with what the Liberals have suggested is that if you're going to run a competition, I think that there are a whole range of different positive attributes related to the F-35. That I think there's no question that at the end of the day, once that aircraft is fully brought into service, and I say fully because it already has been brought into service by the Marine Corps. In the United States. So it's not fully been brought into service as an operational aircraft, but there are several hundred that have been produced, and there are already one component of its operational activities are actually operating right now. So it's not just a theoretical aircraft anymore, but once it's brought in, I don't think there's any question that it's going to be the most capable. The issue in the point of concern is really related to the cost and what you would pay for the capabilities that you get with that aircraft or what you pay for the capabilities in any other. And I think what the NDP have suggested that if you're going to hold a competition, then you should have it held amongst all the potential competitors, and the F-35 is definitely one of the competitors. And if it is simply too costly and too expensive, regardless of the capabilities that it would bring, then it would rule. Then it would be found to be too expensive if you hold the competition. But I don't really see the logic at the outset in saying we're going to compete this, but we're going to restrict the competition because I think amidst all the discussion about the different costs of different aircraft and let's be clear at the outset, they're all
hugely expensive.
Right.
It's just a question of the relative degree to which one or the other might be more or less expensive. And I don't really think that that's fully been established. Mm-hmm. Again, there's a lot of conjecture, but you'd have to do an open competitive bidding like that to really get a good sense of what the different costs
are. So, David,
I fully agree with the NDP.
It sounds to me like you're saying the lower position is defensible, but the NDP position makes more sense to you because it would keep the F-35 in the mix for a proper competitive process. What about the conservative position, which is pretty much a clear preference for the F-35? Is there a case to be made for that?
I would say that the liberal, two things. One, I just to clarify a little bit what you said,
yeah.
I would have tweaked that to say, I think it's totally defensible if you're going to say we need to spend less on fighters.
Yeah.
And then have an open competition to deliver that objective.
Right.
So, you know, we can't afford to spend $9 billion on a fighter aircraft. We can afford to spend whatever they think the number is.
Mm-hmm.
If it was 6, 7, 8, 5, 4, you know,
right.
wherever you want to go.
Gotcha.
Hold a competition to determine what's the best way of delivering on that. In terms of the conservative position, it's not really clear to me that they're actually fully supporting the F-35 because they've been the government. They reset the process that they had launched to buy that aircraft. They launched an independent review. That review, as part of that process, looked at all other options. And when they did that, they actually took that a step back in the procurement process, back to the options analysis phase, where that file has been for a couple of years now. And it hasn't gone anywhere one way or the other. And the government came out and criticized the move that the Liberal Party had suggested of excluding that aircraft, primarily on the industrial benefits grounds. But
right.
to be clear, they have not yet indicated that they would buy that aircraft, unless I've missed something this afternoon.
Well, except I guess you're right, except for the fact that the Prime Minister said the Liberal position, which is, excluding the F-35 would crater the aerospace industry, which it sounded like he was saying it was sort of essential to the industry that we remain part of the F-35 program, right?
But to be clear and elaborate on that, so currently Canadian companies have won. It depends on whose numbers you take and whether or not you just look at the, kind of the tier one suppliers. Somebody had forwarded me some analysis that if you kind of go further down the supply chain, that you actually get to several $100 million more potentially. But at least the official Government of Canada numbers are that around $600 million worth of aerospace contracts have been awarded to Canadian companies. That because Canada is a partner in the consortium.
So it's about $600 million in contracts to Canadian companies that are related to Canada being part of the consortium developing the F-35.
That's correct. So the original part of the deal when we signed on to the MOUs, when we signed a couple of them, but the original ones were to allow us to be involved in the development process related to the aircraft and allow our industry to bid, not necessarily to win, but to bid into, if they won, gain work under that program. So companies to date have been very successful. And there's an estimate that and this is the key part, that if Canada continues to remain in the partnership and we decide to buy the aircraft, there's up to $11 billion worth of work that Canadian companies are eligible to compete on, bid, and win.
Mm.
But gaining that full share requires that we actually decide to buy the aircraft.
Which we have not done. As you correctly say, the Prime Minister has sounded very supportive, but he's stopped well clear of committing us to buying
correct.
The aircraft going forward. Yeah.
So if you really want to have a real complete discussion about what the impact is of the Canadian domestic aerospace industry, and I do definitely think that there are definitely going to be impacts if we leave, and some firms would be at a disadvantage. If you went another route with a guaranteed industrial offset model, you could get a different type of benefit, although it would be qualitatively different. But to get the impact domestically on the aerospace industry and the full benefit from Joint Strike Fighter, you actually have to make a decision to buy that aircraft, and so far nobody has done that.
That was David Perry, senior analyst with the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, talking with Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes. That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.